Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Nehemiah chapter 12, verses 1 through 47. We will look at the dedication of the wall around Jerusalem. Our context is this. In Nehemiah 11, we see that lots were drawn and volunteers were taken from the residents surrounding the villages outside of Jerusalem so that one-tenth of them could live in Jerusalem to repopulate the city. So we start now in verse 1 of chapter 12. Now these are the priests and the Levites who came up with Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Jeshua. Now, of course, that's Zerubbabel, the governor that came to Jerusalem from Persia under the Edict of Cyrus in 538 BC, and Jeshua, the high priest, the political and religious leaders. Now, there are lots of lists of names in Nehemiah. I'm not going to read all these names to you, but let me give you a summary of four lists of names in the book. First of all, we have the Israelite population of the whole province. That's in Nehemiah 7:5. Now, my God put it into my mind to assemble the nobles, the officials, and the peoples to be registered by genealogy. So that's everybody that came or that was there in Nehemiah's time. And then we have names on a sealed written covenant. It's not a genealogy. It's a list of names that signed the covenant. These are leaders, Nehemiah 10:1. Those whose seals were on the document were Nehemiah the governor and dot, 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 dot. And the third list of names are the names that I mentioned that were in the last chapter, Nehemiah 11, Judah and Benjamin's descendants who moved to Jerusalem from the surrounding areas when they took the lot and they took volunteers. Nehemiah 11:1-2, now the leaders of the people stayed in Jerusalem and the rest of the people cast lots for 1 out of 10 to come and live in Jerusalem, while the other 9/10 remained in their towns. The people praised all the men who volunteered to live in Jerusalem, and we see these people that live in Jerusalem in verse 4 of Nehemiah 11. While some of the descendants of Judah and Benjamin settled in Jerusalem, Judah's descendants were dot, 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 and then in 11:7, these were Benjamin's descendants, dot, dot, dot. And the fourth list of names are the priests and the Levites, which are here in chapter 12, and that's what we're going to be looking at before we get to the dedication of a wall. Now, the first six priests of the second temple are listed in verses 10 through 11. By the way, that Jeshua in verse 1 is also called Joshua elsewhere. Joshua, same guy. Now, this enumeration of the priest was of great importance because henceforth the chronology of the Jews was to be reckoned by the succession of high priest, not by a succession of kings. Now, before we get to verse 10, of course, we have a list of just ordinary priests. But then we get to verse 10, we've got Jeshua became the father of Jehoiakim. Jeshua was the first high priest, then Jehoiakim. Jehoiakim became the father of Eliashib, the third high priest, and then Elisha became the father of Jehoiada, the fourth high priest, and Jehoiada became the father of Jonathan, the fifth high priest, and Jonathan became the father of Jadua, the sixth high priest. Now, in verse 1, we have a mention of a Seraiah, S-E-R-A-I-A-H, as an ordinary priest. The original Seraiah, there was an earlier Seraiah, was the high priest who was murdered by Nebuchadnezzar, as the pulpit commentator says, so that's might be worth remembering. 2 Kings 25:18, first part of the verse, and 21, first part of the verse. The commander of the guards also took away Seraiah the chief. That's the commander of the guards is Nebuzaradan, who was working for Nebuchadnezzar. This is 586 BC when the Babylonians wiped out Jerusalem. Nebuzaradan took away Seraiah the chief priest, dot, 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 took them and brought them to the king of Babylon at Riblah, that's right north of Jerusalem. The king of Babylon, that's Nebuchadnezzar, put them to death, put Seraiah to death, as well as his compadres in the land of Hamath. So, Bible trivia time, who was the high priest murdered by Nebuchadnezzar? That would be Seraiah. Jeremiah is listed in verse 1. That's not our famous Jeremiah. He was before 586 B.C. We're now in 445/444 B.C., long time ago. Ezra now is mentioned in the end of verse 1. Now, this is interesting because Ezra, of course, had come over a mere 13, 14 years earlier. And so the question is this the same Ezra that's mentioned here in the list of priests? Adam Clark says this Ezra in verse 1 is generally allowed to be the same Ezra who wrote the book of Ezra. And if that were true, he would now be upward of 100 years old, which is a little bit old, but it's possible. Here's what John Gill says. Ezra may be Ezra, the priest and scribe, who came up with Zerubbabel and returned to Babylon and came back again, as we looked at in the book of Ezra. though this by some is not thought very probable. So you see there's some doubt about it. Here's what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say about it. This was most likely a different person from the pious and patriotic leader. So some people say, yeah, for sure it's Ezra. Some people say, well, maybe it's Ezra. And now Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says, no, it's definitely not Ezra. So obviously nobody knows who it was. The age is the problem. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say if he were the same person, if this Ezra was the same person as the priest Ezra, he would now, I mean, not the priest Ezra, but the famous Ezra, he would now have reached a very patriarchal age, and this longevity would doubtless be due to his eminent piety and temperance, which are greatly conducive to the prolongation of life, but above all to the special blessing of God who had preserved and strengthened him for the accomplishment of the important work he was called upon to undertake in that critical period of the church's history. Of course, when he says church, he means the Old Testament church, as these non-dispensational commentators like to say. I don't like to say it, actually. I just like to say it's the Old Testament, the Old Covenant Jews. But at any rate, Jameson, Fawcett, Brown says that if this is Ezra here, he's so godly that that godliness actually prolonged his life. Verse 4, there's an Abijah mentioned. Abijah was one of the ancestors of John the Baptist, Luke 1:5. In the days of Herod, king of Judea, there was a priest named Zacharias of the division of Abijah. And of course, that Zacharias is the father of John the Baptist. Now in verse 7, we read this. These were the heads of the priests. These referring to a whole bunch of names that were written before. These were the heads of the priest. Now, optionally, that could mean that they were the heads of the 24 courses of the priest. That's the way the commentator Poole takes it. These 24 courses were established by David's 1 Chronicles 24:18. You'll see the 1 Chronicles 24. You will see the list of the courses. Verse 18 has the 23rd course for Delaiah, the 24th course for Maaziah. Or it could just mean the heads of the priests. These were the chiefs or the priest of greatest note in the time of Jeshua the high priest. I think it's probably the 24 course heads. Verse 9, we see that, well, let me just read verse 9. Also, Bakbukiah and Uni stood opposite in their service divisions. What is a service division? The NIV translates it as the services. The Levites were divided into 24 sections and placed opposite each other. That, of course, would be the 24 courses, the famous 24 courses. These 24 courses, by the way, were the courses of priests that would come up and minister in the temple once every 2 weeks because it was too hard on the priest to do it for the whole year. Now we have a little problem here. Let me read you what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says about these 24 courses or service divisions, as the NASB has it. Only four of the courses returned from the captivity, but these were divided by Zerubbabel, or maybe Jeshua, into the original number of 24. But now, in Nehemiah 12:1-9, where we are now, there are only 22 enumerated. And then when you get down to Nehemiah 12:12-21, there's only 20 courses enumerated. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown explains the discrepancy this way. The discrepancy is due to the extremely probable circumstance that two of the 24 courses had become extinct in Babylon, for none belonged to them or reported as having returned in verses 2-5 in our genealogy here. And then when you get down to Nehemiah 12:12-21, we see that Hattush and Madiah may be omitted in the account of these persons' families, for they had no sons. Well, that's a little bit complicated. I'm not exactly sure I follow what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown is saying there. Doesn't really matter, unless you really want to get into the weeds here. Now we go to another priest who's mentioned in verse 11. Now, this is a high priest, not just a priest. His name is Jaddua, J-A-D-D-U-A. Sounds like somebody in a Star Wars bar. Josephus supposes this Jaddua is the high priest Jaddus who went to meet Alexander the Great in a famous scene after Alexander had conquered Tyre and Gaza. Now, Alexander was 100 years later, 332-323 B.C. So if this is the famous Jaddua who went out to meet Alexander the Great when Alexander showed up in Jerusalem, this shows that somebody besides Nehemiah wrote this, because Nehemiah didn't live that long. Nehemiah's second trip to Jerusalem was 432. He stayed there to 423, somewhere along those years, that's 100 years before Alexander the Great. So this would mean, and of course some people say that Nehemiah was not the person who compiled his book. Well now, in the story of Alexander the Great, this high priest Jaddus came to Alexander and showed him the book of Daniel. And of course, if you recall the book of Daniel, it has prophecies about Alexander the Great in it. The goat with the big horn, if I remember correctly. And Alexander was pretty impressed by that. I'm sure it made his big head get even bigger. And so Alexander says, okay, we're not going to destroy Jerusalem. Let me read you an account of that meeting from Adam Clark concerning Jaddua. Quote, "This was probably the high priest who went in his pontifical robes accompanied by his brethren to meet Alexander the Great when he was advancing towards Jerusalem with the purpose to destroy it after having conquered Tyre and Gaza. Alexander was so struck with the appearance of the priest that he forbore all hostilities against Jerusalem, prostrated himself before Jaddua, worshipped the Lord at the temple, and granted many privileges to the Jews." Now, Josephus records this. If you'll read the histories of Alexander the Great, this is a standard story. It's a good story. It's not legend or myth. It actually happened. Now, whether this is the same Jaddua or not, who knows? It would have to be 100 years later. Here's what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say about this. "It is an opinion entertained by many commentators that this person was the high priest whose dignified appearance, solemn manner, and splendid costume overawed and interested so strongly the proud mind of Alexander the Great. And if he were not this person, as some object that this Jaddua was not in office till a considerable period after the death of Nehemiah, so if it were not this person, it might probably be his father, called by the same name." In other words, Nehemiah's Jaddua might be the father of Alexander the Great's Jaddua. Interesting speculations. We go down to Nehemiah 12, verse 22. "As for the Levites, the heads of fathers' households were registered in the days of Eliashib, Joiada, and Johanan, and Jaddua. So were the priests in the reign of Darius the Persian." Now we have a mention of Darius the Persian. First of all, we have a mention of Eliashib. He was the third priest of the second temple. Joiada was the fourth, Johanan was the fifth, and Jaddua was the sixth, as I said earlier. And all of these priests, or not all of these priests, but other priests were mentioned here as being in existence in the reign of Darius the Persian. Well, which Darius is this? Of course, it's not Darius the Great. Commentators split between Darius the Second, who reigned between 423 and 405/404, or Darius the Third, who reigned between 336 and 330. Now, if it's Darius the Third, obviously, then that means Nehemiah couldn't have written the book, because he was finished about 423 or so. His second trip to Jerusalem, according to the ESV Study Bible, is dated between 433 and 423. Darius the Third is 336 and 330. So obviously, if this Darius the Persian that's mentioned here is Darius the Third, then it's not Nehemiah who wrote the book. Now, who holds to Darius the Third? Well, we've got Gill, the Pulpit Commentary, the Cambridge Commentary. Now, this Darius the Third is famous in Alexander the Great story too. Alexander chased him down through the desert, and he ended up, I think if I remember correctly, as he was just about to get caught out there in Central Asia, killed himself so he wouldn't get caught by Alexander. It's a good story. The commentator Poole, Matthew Poole, says that, well, it might be Darius the Third, but it might be Darius the Second. So he's kind of ambivalent. Adam Clark and Colin Dillidge say it's Darius the Second, who ruled between 423 and 405/404. Now, if it's this Darius the Second, his reign is just contemporaneous with Nehemiah, because Nehemiah finished in 423, his second trip to Jerusalem. But, of course, he could have gone back to Susa and written his book then. So he's at the beginning of Darius the Second's reign. So if I had to take a guess, my life depended on it, I'd say this is talking about Darius the Second. But it's interesting to me that these names that show up in ancient history, Persian history, show up in the Bible too. We go to Nehemiah 12, verses 23 through 26. "The sons of Levi, the heads of fathers' households, were registered in the book of Chronicles." Well, this is not the book of Chronicles that we have now. It's not the canonical book of Chronicles, because there's no matching list that's found in Chronicles. As Adam Clark says, it's now from some currently lost other book or register. Jameson, Fawcett, Brown say that these chronicles are the public registers in which the genealogies were kept with great regularity and exactness. Well, there's no question about that. They really kept up with names. And so in verse 24, we have some heads of Levites mentioned, whose names I'm not going to read to you. And then we go to verse 25. More names were gatekeepers keeping watch at the storehouses of the gates. Adam Clark says of these storehouses, quote, may we not suppose these to resemble our watch boxes or some temporary movable shelters for those who took care of the gates? Interesting. They had some kind of way to store collections without getting them stolen. These are to the days of Joiakim. He is one of the six high priests that are listed in this genealogy. Joiakim is the son of Jeshua, so he's number two. And Jeshua is the son of Jozadak. He was the high priest back when the Jews were in Jerusalem, in Babylonia. And in the days of Nehemiah, the governor, and Ezra, the priest, and scribe. So there's some time references there. We go to Nehemiah 12, verses 27 through 29. And we get away from the genealogy, and we start on the dedication of the wall of Jerusalem. Now, at the dedication of the wall of Jerusalem, they sought out the Levites from all their places to bring them to Jerusalem so that they might celebrate the dedication with gladness. Now, remember, the Levites scattered all over, as they always were, scattered in towns all over Israel. So they gathered them together to go to Jerusalem to celebrate the dedication with gladness, hymns of thanksgiving, and with songs to the accompaniment of cymbals, harps, and lyres. Remember, the Levites were famous for singing. That was one of their duties, and so that's why they got the Levites to come into the city to dedicate the wall. Verse 28, so the sons of the singers were assembled from the district around Jerusalem and from the villages of the Netophathites, from Beth Gilgal and from their fields in Geba and Azmaveth, for the singers had built themselves villages around Jerusalem. All right, so these villages around Jerusalem, where the Levite singers live, let's look at the village of the Netophathites. I guess the village would be called Netophath. The word means distillation or dropping. It's a town in Judah, probably in the neighborhood of Bethlehem, according to Easton's Dictionary. Now, Geba is about 5 miles due north of the Mount of Olives, which, of course, is right east of Jerusalem, across the Kidron Valley. So some singers live there. Then we have some singers living in Beth Gilgal, in the plains of Jericho. That's not far from Jerusalem as you go northeast. Now, there's so many Gilgals all over Jerusalem. Could be the Gilgal right where Joshua crossed over. I don't know. Beth just means house of Gilgal. Geba, I've already mentioned Geba, 5 miles north, due north of the Mount of Olives. It was a Levitical city in the tribe of Benjamin, and it was already apportioned there too by Joshua, Joshua 21. And then there's a village called Azmaveth, which is mentioned in Nehemiah 7 as a town that was probably, very probably, in the tribe of Benjamin. So all these little towns outside of Jerusalem, the singing Levites were recruited to come to the dedication of the wall. We go now to Nehemiah 12, verses 30 through 31. The priests and the Levites purified themselves. They also purified the people, the gates, and the wall. Everybody was pure. Then I had the leaders of Judah come up on top of the wall, and I appointed two great choirs, the first proceeding to the right on top of the wall toward the refuse gate, or the dung gate. Now notice, before this ceremony even started, all the purification that's going on. The priests and Levites purified themselves, so the priests and Levites are purified, then the people were purified, then the gates were purified, and the wall was purified. So how does this take place? Well, here's some options, at least as far as the purification of the priests and the Levites. It could have been done by washing their bodies and clothes. When the Levites were originally consecrated to serve in the temple, they had water of purification sprinkled on them. We read that in Numbers 8, 6, and 7. Take the Levites from among the sons of Israel and cleanse them. Thus you shall do to them for their cleansing. Sprinkle purifying water on them, and let them use a razor over their whole body and wash their clothes, and they will be clean. I wouldn't be surprised if they did the same thing here before they dedicated the wall, sprinkled themselves with water, shaved their whole body, and then washed their clothes. The NIV Study Bible suggests that maybe they purified themselves by abstaining sexually from their wives. I love how that is. You know, you get unclean when you have sex. And no wonder the early church had trouble with sex being dirty. I just read that the famous 13th century king Louis IX, Saint Louis, as they called him, he needed an heir to the throne, so he had sex with his wife. He felt very bad about that. He confessed God for his sin. He felt it was a sin to lust after his wife. But of course, this is not talking about sex being dirty. It's talking about Levitical cleanness, ritual purity. The NIV Study Bible also suggests maybe these priests fasted before they went up on the wall to dedicate the wall. The NIV Study Bible also said it's not clear exactly what they did. Well, of course, we just speculate now. But whatever they did, their outward acts were obviously accompanied by a proper inner heart attitude, a repentance and recommitment to God, as the NIV Study Bible says. Now, how did they purify the gates? How did they purify the wall? Well, Adam Clark says they just removed all filth from the gates, construction rubbish, or maybe actually rubbish people threw stuff out of the house or something along the wall. All rubbish which was laid up against the walls were removed, and now the gates are clean. Verse 31, then Nehemiah had the leaders of Judah come up on top of the wall, and he appointed two great choirs. Now, the first choir proceeded to the right. Now, all of this depends upon where the starting point was, because Nehemiah is going to put the singers on top of the wall, the Levite singers, and then he's going to split them up into two choirs. Well, let me give you some options as to where the starting point was, where the splitting took place. Opinions run all over the gamut here. The Cambridge commentator says that the starting point seems to have been the Valley Gate. That's the gate at the southwestern corner of the wall. Ellicott is similar to Cambridge. He says it's somewhere on the southwestern wall, not necessarily the Valley Gate, but somewhere in the vicinity. Another option is the Dung Gate, which is at the southeast corner of the wall. That's Adam Clark's view. The pulpit commentator says it was probably the central portion of the western wall. So this proves to me that nobody has any clue as to where the division took place. I'm just going to assume it was somewhere on the southwest. Why not? Why not the Valley Gate? That's right in the middle of the south. That's right. That's between the west and the southeast. So we'll say the Valley Gate. Now, Adam Clark describes the procession this way. The following seems to have been the order of the procession. He divided the priests, the Levites, the magistrates, and the people into two companies. Now, I should point out that it was not just the singing Levites that were up there. Priests were up there. Political leaders, magistrates, and just general people were up there. Each company to go around one half of the wall. They began at the Dung Gate. This is Clark's view. As I pointed out, not everybody agrees with that. One party going to the right and the other to the left. Well, if you go to the right from either the Dung Gate or the Valley Gate, you're going counterclockwise. If you're going to the left, you're going clockwise. So we're going to call the two choirs the counterclockwise choir and the clockwise choir. These two choirs, continuing with Clark, they met at the great space opposite to the temple, where they all offered many sacrifices to God and rejoiced with exceeding great joy, shouting so that the noise was heard a great way off. By the way, a translation issue here, or difference, the NASB translates the southwestern gate as the refuse gate. Most translations call that the dung gate, the poop gate. Well, no, they don't say it's the poop gate, but Dung Gate is where the sewage went out of the city, so I think Dung Gate is a much better translation there. We go now to Nehemiah 12, verses 32 through 36. Hoshea and half of the leaders of Judah followed them. Now, who are they following? They're following the counterclockwise half, the half that proceeded to the right toward the Dung Gate from somewhere in the southwest corner of the city, of the wall. So this is the counterclockwise choir. The names are mentioned of people who are in that choir, dot, 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 dot. One of those names is Ezra, but that has to be a different Ezra from the famous Ezra that wrote the book of Ezra, the one who returned in 458 BC, because that Ezra led this counterclockwise choir going from the Dung Gate all the way up to the Temple Mount. It says that in verse 36, and Ezra the scribe went before them. He went before them because he had great prominence, and so he led. Before that, notice in verse 36, we see a bunch of names who came carrying the musical instruments of David, the man of God. Now, of course, David's not still around. He was 1070 to 1030 BC, and we are now 445, 444 BC. But that just means the instruments that David had prescribed. He had said, we're going to set up our choirs this way. Here are the instruments. And they were still using the same instruments half a millennium later. We go now to Nehemiah 12, verse 37. At the fountain gate, they went directly up the steps of the city of David by the stairway of the wall above the house of David to the water gate on the east. Now we're getting into the gates of the wall. You have to use a map for this. Before I talk about these individual gates that are mentioned, I ask myself a question. How do they get past each gate as they march? Now, remember, the gates have been fixed by now. I'm assuming that as they walk on top of the wall, when they get to the gate, they walk over the gatehouse that is over, that is between the two sides of the gate. Now remember, a gatehouse would go from the outside of the wall to the inside of the wall. The wall's pretty wide now because they're marching on it. I wouldn't be surprised if the wall's 10 feet wide. I don't know, but it was wide enough to march on. And so there's a gatehouse covering that 10-foot gap, and it has a roof. And I'm assuming, I don't know this, but I'm assuming that the choirs walked over the roof and just kept right on walking on the walls as they headed for the temple. Now let's look at some of these gates. At the fountain gate, the dung gate's on the southeastern corner of the walls. It's right south of the Pool of Siloam, famous Pool of Siloam, which is at the end of the Spring of Gihon. Pool of Siloam, which may be the king's pool, may be a different pool, I don't know, but there was a pool there, right there in the southwest corner of the dung gates, right there at that pool. And as you go, as you turn the corner of the southeast corner and head north, the first gate you hit is the fountain gate. Now at that gate there's a stairway that leads into an inner wall that covers the southern tip of Mount Zion, as Mount Zion sinks down into a plain there. So there's an inner wall and an outer wall. I'm going to assume we're still on the outer wall. The fountain gate is right there where those two walls come together. The tip of the inner wall hits the outer wall right north of the fountain gate approximately. And there's a stairway that's mentioned. Now that stairway, I don't think anybody knows exactly how it ran. Some people say it just, once you get on the other side of the fountain gate, that it actually is in the wall itself, and you climb the steps to get to the upper part of the wall, kind of like the Great Wall of China, the steps everywhere. Or it could be as you go through the fountain gate from outside to inside the wall, you climb the stairs and go through the inner wall into the house of David. I don't know. I don't think anybody knows for sure. Now, our verse here mentions the house of David. The tombs of David are there, but also the house of David. Now, that location is unsure as exactly to where that was, but an Israeli archaeologist claims that she found the House of David in 1997. I don't know whether she's right or not, because I'm not an archaeologist. I have the site to it. It's kind of interesting. At any rate, the choir, headed by Ezra's counterclockwise choir, heads north to the next gate, which is the water gate, which is the gate right outside the famous spring of Gihon, which is on the banks of Mount Zion as it slopes down into the Kidron Valley. And so now we go to Nehemiah 12, verses 38 through 39. And in Nehemiah 12, 38 and 39, we'll look at the second choir, which I'll call the clockwise choir, or I could call it the Nehemiah choir, because he's the one in charge of this one. The second choir proceeded to the left, i.e. to the left from somewhere on the south wall, maybe at the valley gate at the southwestern corner. Second choir proceeded to the left while I, that's Nehemiah, followed them. So he didn't lead his choir. He followed that choir. I don't know why. With half of the people on the wall above the Tower of Furnaces to the broad wall. Well, the Tower of Furnaces is named that because probably the tower was near to ovens which were used for baking bread or bricks. And people don't know exactly where that is, but my map has it right to the north of the Valley Gate, Tower of the Ovens, and then next comes the broad wall. Now, this broad wall apparently is the wall that was torn down by Joash of the northern kingdom when he attacked Amaziah of the southern kingdom. Let's read Nehemiah 3:8 concerning this broad wall, which reached from the gate of Ephraim, which is lost, or at least I don't know where it is, from the gate of Ephraim to the corner gate, which is at the northwestern corner of the wall. This wall was broken down by Jehoash, king of Israel, but was rebuilt so strong by Uzziah, king of Judah, that it stood firm to this time. This is according to Gil. So we got it built by Jehoash. His dates are 798 to 782, and then rebuilt by Uzziah, 767 to 740. Now, Gil gets that by reading 2 Chronicles 25:23. King Jehoash, he ruled 798 to 782, of Israel, captured Judah's king Amaziah, who ruled from 796 to 767. So we're talking about early 8th century B.C. They had their famous battle, the little thorn attacking the cedar of Lebanon, Amaziah being the thorn, Jehoash being the cedar of Lebanon. Then Jehoash took Amaziah to Jerusalem and broke down 200 yards of Jerusalem's wall from the Ephraim gate to the corner gate. Don't know where the Ephraim gate is. The corner gate is at the northwest corner. So we're talking about 200 yards broken down. And then Uzziah apparently rebuilt the wall, 2 Chronicles 26:9. Moreover, Uzziah, who was a little bit later, 767 to 740, built towers in Jerusalem at the corner gate and at the valley gate at the corner buttress and fortified them. Well, that sounds like he built towers. Of course, if you're going to build a tower, you're probably going to rebuild a wall in between it. So I guess that's reasonable. But I found some interesting stuff about the broad wall concerning archaeology. Let me read from a website called attractionsinisrael.com. In 1970, the Broad Wall was discovered by Professor Avigad. The Broad Wall is about 8 meters wide and it was originally about 8 meters high. Houses alongside were destroyed to build the wall. So they actually think they found this Broad Wall. We found another website called BibleWalks.com says this. Excavations in the Jewish Quarter in the Old City of Jerusalem unearthed a section of the first temple wall built by Hezekiah during the 8th century. Now, it says temple wall here, not city wall, so I'm not sure we're talking about the same thing. Hezekiah was even later than Uzziah. He was 716 to 687. So Hezekiah built this wall. Continuing with this website, the wall was intended to protect the city against the Assyrians. The impressive wall, about 8 meters thick and 8 meters high, I'm assuming this is the same wall that was found by Professor Avigad in 1970, strengthened the defense of the city. The name of the wall was used in a later time in the history of the city when Nehemiah returns from the Babylonian exile and rebuilds the wall in the first phase of the Second Temple. He built the city in a smaller scale, but on the west section he reuses the Hezekiah Broad Wall as written in the Bible, and they fortified Jerusalem unto the Broad Wall. According to most scholars, this Broad Wall is at this site, what remained from the First Temple era. In other words, the Babylonians couldn't knock it down because it was too strong. Well, that, I think, would deserve some further study, which I don't have time to do. Whether it was Uzziah or Hezekiah that rebuilt that broad wall, I don't know. But I do know that Nehemiah's choir walked over it on its way clockwise, heading to the rendezvous with the Eastern choir at the Temple Mount. Some gates that are mentioned, the Gate of Ephraim, I don't know where that is, it's not on my map, but the old gate is the same thing as the corner gate at the northwestern corner. You keep going as you now, you turn east and go along the northern wall, you hit the fish gate, that's probably where fish were sold. Then you go to the Tower of Hananel, which is next, and then the next tower, the Tower of Mia, or the Tower of the Hundred, maybe because there's 100 cubits before you get to the sheep gate, possibly 100 cubits from the Tower of Hananel on the western side. Or maybe it was 100 cubits high, the Tower of the Hundred. It'd be pretty high, actually. And then, of course, at the northeast, the Sheep Gate, where sheep were brought in to the Temple Mount in order to be sacrificed at the temple. The last gate that's mentioned is the Gate of the Guard. The KJV, the New American Bible, has the Prison Gate. And Holman Bible Dictionary says that's probably identical with the Muster Gate, which is right there somewhere at the northeastern corner. My map has it at on the eastern wall at the northeastern corner, the eastern wall of the Temple Mount area. Soldiers were probably mustered there. So at any rate, the two choirs have met at the temple. We go now to Nehemiah 12, verses 40 through 43. Then the two choirs took their stand in the house of God, the temple. So did I, Nehemiah speaking, and half of the officials with me, and the priests, I'm not going to read them all. And the singers sang with Jezrahiah their leader, and on that day they offered great sacrifices and rejoiced, because God had given them great joy. Even the women and children rejoiced, so that the joy of Jerusalem was heard from afar. We go down to Nehemiah 12, verses 44 through 45. On that day men were also appointed over the chambers for the stores, the contributions, the first fruits, and the tithes, to gather into them from the fields of the cities the portions required by law for the priests and Levites. For Judah rejoiced over the priests and Levites who served, for they performed the worship of their God in the service of purification, together with the singers and the gatekeepers, in accordance with the command of David and of his son Solomon. Verse 44 mentions the chambers for the stores. That's where they kept things like first fruits, barley, wheat, figs, grapes, contributions. That might even mean animals maybe, or maybe gold and silver. They must have had storehouses maybe built alongside the walls of this new temple, maybe freestanding in the temple courtyard. I'm not sure which. Contributions is translated as offerings in some translations. That would be animals. First fruits. Remember, there was the first fruits of the barley harvest after the Passover festival. And then there was the first fruits of the Feast of Weeks in May and June, Sivan. Passover was in Nisan, April, May, or March, April, I'm sorry, March, April. And then Sivan in May, June, that's the wheat first fruits. And then in Tishri, September, October, you had the first fruits of the fruit. Grapes, figs, olives, all that stuff was stored in the storehouses there. It seems there was great joy doing that. They contributed with a joyful heart because it says, for Judah rejoiced over the priests and Levites. They were glad to give of their surplus because the priests and Levites were doing their duty. They performed the worship of their God in the service of purification. They sang, they kept the gates in accordance with the command of David and of his son Solomon. David and Solomon, of course, were telling them to do it according to the law, the Mosaic law. Now, these singers served the temple in successive courses, just like the priest, so there would never be singers lacking in the temple. Perhaps there's 24 courses of Levites singing. I wouldn't be surprised. The priest and the Levites are now enabled to stay in the temple area there. They wouldn't have to come from having to work in the fields and villages. They could come into the temple and live off of the donations that are coming in. The gatekeepers, their job was to keep all ceremonially unclean persons or things out. Gill and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown suggest that's what the service of purification that they did was, by keeping the unclean out. I don't know. I think the service of purification sounds to me more like sprinkling the Levites with water. That's what service of purification was. I don't think that directly had a reference to gatekeepers. Maybe it did. I don't know. We go to Nehemiah 12, verses 46 through 47. For in the days of David and Asaph in ancient times, there were leaders of these singers. Now, Asaph, I mentioned in the previous podcast, Asaph wrote 12 psalms, and he was in charge of the singers, the Levite singers, in the times of King David. He's mentioned several times as we go through these lists of names in Nehemiah, so he's kind of famous. It's also mentioned in 1 Chronicles 25, too, of the sons of Asaph, Sons of Asaph were under the direction of Asaph, who prophesied under the direction of the king. Asaph was also a seer, it says in another verse, which I don't have here, and here it says that he prophesied. So Asaph is a singer-prophet. And the chapter finishes off by saying that all Israel gave, that's their tithe, to the singers and the gatekeepers, as each day required. In other words, there was enough so that it could be done every day, the singing and the gatekeeping. And all people set apart the consecrated portion for the Levites, so they gave a tenth to the Levites, and then the Levites set apart their consecrated portion, the tithe of the tithes. They received tithes, the Levites did, then they gave tithes. The Levites received tithes from the people, and then the Levites gave a tithe to the priest, the sons of Aaron. And on that happy note, we have finished Nehemiah chapter 12. That prepares us to go to the last chapter in Nehemiah, Nehemiah 13, and we will look at Nehemiah's final reforms. I hope you stay tuned for that chapter, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.